From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. October 1846, a Sierra snowstorm blocked a group of emigrants bound for California. For many, Truckee Lake was as far as they would get. The Donner Party, 160 years on, today on Insight. So today, is $6.15 an hour an appropriate minimum wage in Nevada? Voters will soon decide that question. Plus, what would happen if every Californian who's eligible to vote actually voted? A new study says the changes in local and state politics would be radical. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, 160 years ago this month, dozens of migrants headed for California were trapped at Truckee Lake. When spring finally came, dozens of the Donner Party were dead. Also, how would California politics change if everyone who could vote did? First, Nevada voters will soon decide whether to raise their state's minimum wage. It's currently $5.15 an hour. Ballot question 6 would raise it to $6.15 and tie it from now on to rising inflation rates. In a few minutes, you'll hear from an opponent. We'll start with the initiative's author. He's Danny Thompson, executive treasurer and secretary of the Nevada State AFL-CIO. Danny, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Why does Nevada need to raise its minimum wage, in your opinion?
Well, it's ridiculous to believe that someone can eat off of $5.15 an hour. And, you know, we find that our research shows that one in four of these people is a single mother who works full-time some 70% of the time. And 79% of these people are over the age of 20. So we're not talking about teenagers or senior citizens. We're talking about people who are trying to live off that ridiculous amount. And you know, if you value work and these people who work 40 hours a week and don't make enough money to eat, that's just something that needs to be fixed. And, you know, Congress has not addressed this for 10 years now. And in those 10 years, I mean, the inflation and increase in cost has eroded that $5.15 to a ridiculously low amount. And it's just time to change it.
You said it's ridiculous to expect anyone to eat when they make $5.15 an hour, but why would they be much better off at $6.15 an hour? It still seems rather low.
It is rather low, considering that California's minimum wage is now $8 an hour. Washington State is $7.63. Oregon is $7.50. This is not going to be the end-all, be-all for these people, but it certainly is going to help. I recall a minimum wage earner who testified before the Nevada State Senate, and that very question was posed to this woman who was a single mother. And they said, really, is a dollar really going to help you? She says, a dollar is $40 a week to me, and it certainly is going to help put food on my table.
Where did you get $6.15 an hour from? I mean, you could have raised it. You could have said $6 or $7 or whatever. Why $6.15?
The federal minimum wage is $5.15 an hour, and Nevada's law is tied to the federal minimum wage. Nevada's minimum wage law says whatever the federal minimum wage law, federal minimum wage is what the Nevada law will be.
Danny Thompson of the Nevada AFL-CIO. We're also joined by Harry York, who's CEO of the Reno Sparks Chamber of Commerce. He's opposed to the minimum wage initiative. Harry, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
Why do you oppose this initiative?
Well, we had two primary reasons. One, the first one was that it's being written into our state constitution. And we believe that topics and issues like this do not belong in the Constitution. They should be dealt with legislatively. The Constitution should be looking at big policy issues that are somewhat historic and more basic.
And your other objection
was that there's no need, that the marketplace takes care of this, and certainly in this area, you can hardly find anybody that's working for less than $8.50 to $10 an hour. Every fast food place has signs up that say, that they're hiring at $9.50, $10 an hour. Pretty hard to find somebody that's working at minimum wage or even at the proposed minimum wage change.
Danny, why should this be written into the Constitution?
Well, I served in the Nevada State Assembly for 10 years and I've been the chief lobbyist for who I work for now for the past 16 years. I've been there 26 years. The reason it's in the Constitution is because whatever the legislature does in one session, they can undo in the next session. And, if they passed a minimum wage increase and then undid it, it would have a drastic effect on those people.
But isn't that true of any change in the law? I mean, if that's a valid argument, then why not put every law into the Constitution?
Well, certainly this has been something that no one has been willing to tackle. The state government hasn't been willing to tackle it, and certainly the federal government hasn't been willing to tackle this for 10 years. And so if you're one of those people who are out there trying to eat off on that, live off of that amount of money, that's why we felt that it should be in the Constitution.
Danny, many minimum wage earners are young people not supporting a household. Do you think that raising the minimum wage might price some entry-level workers out of a job?
In fact, that is not the truth. 79% of the minimum wage earners are over 20 in Nevada. One in four is a single mother. In other states that raised the minimum wage, they didn't see that happen. They didn't see losses of jobs in Washington or Oregon State. And certainly, California just raised theirs, and I don't think there's been, it hasn't been the end of the world for them.
They did Harry? Not put it in the Constitution, though.
Well, whether they put it in the Constitution doesn't negate the fact that they raised the minimum wage and it didn't have the drastic effects that everyone is saying, that the other side is saying. This issue polled at 77% in a recent poll done by the Las Vegas Review-Journal. It's its second time around. The first time it got more votes than any candidate or any other issue on the ballot, and it passed almost 2-1 in every county. So I'm pretty confident that this is going to pass.
Harry, you said earlier that one of your two objections to the minimum wage initiative is that the market doesn't justify it, I think is what you said. Could you talk more about that?
Sure. And it's just, looking at observations. I think one time last session, Danny actually came to the legislature with a number of those people who were working at the minimum wage level, and he had to go back and revise that number. And the number statewide is not very significant. I'm not sure where he got those numbers, what type of worker that is, but it's the marketplace takes care of those things. And if you can't hire somebody at one level, you've got to end up raising your rate to pay somebody to get good help.
Do we have any figures here, hard figures? Danny, can you tell us how many people in Nevada earn the minimum wage?
Our research came from the Economic Policy Institute of Washington, D.C. Think tank that the research that they provided said that by increasing, and here was the mix-up on the number, that 100,000 people would be affected, and that is to say that there are 100,000 between 515 and 615, there are 100,000 people in Nevada making that wage. And if the market would take care of this, we wouldn't be talking about it. If the market had raised it, look at the price of gas has been astronomical in the West. The price of electricity has risen drastically. The price of natural gas, and these are things you can't live without. The market hasn't taken care of them, and they've been stuck at $5.15 an hour for 10 years, and nothing's been done either by the market or by Congress.
Harry, if, as you say, there aren't too many people in Nevada with the minimum wage, and I don't know whether that's true or not, but for the sake of argument, let's just say that there aren't that many, then what harm would it do if you did raise the minimum wage?
Again, that's where it comes back to being in the Constitution, and we'd rather just see it be done statutorily. There was actually a proposal in the last session to raise it immediately by about $1.40, I believe, but not put it into the Constitution. Danny and his people did not feel that was the way to go. They wanted to lock it in the Constitution.
Well, another key element to this initiative is that it would tie future raises to the minimum wage to the inflation rate. Danny, tell us why you included that in the initiative.
Well, first of all, we didn't kill that bill last session. It died of its own weight. The legislators didn't like the fact. It wasn't the fact that it was going into the Constitution that bothered them. What they didn't like was what you just said. And that is our initiative has a provision in it that says that the minimum wage would be adjusted annually by the rate of inflation that's recorded in the CPI and capped at 3%. Now, there's been a lot of people out there saying, oh, this is going to be $8, $9 an hour. If you're capped at 3%, the most it could go up this next year would be 18 cents. And so that was the part that the legislators didn't like, and that's why one house fought for that and the other house didn't, and so they couldn't come to an agreement. And it was a dollar. It wasn't a dollar 40.
Harry, what do you think about tying the minimum wage to the increases in the minimum wage to the inflation rate? I mean, one argument in favor of that would be that it would eliminate this contentious debate.
Well, I think another part to that, though, is that what is the inflation rate? And I don't know that anybody knows. You know, we use a certain number, but if you look at that number, it has a whole lot of things that are pulled out of it. I think it should just be something that's looked at, you know, on a regular basis.
And how regular would regular be?
Well, in this state, probably be best that it's done every legislative session since we meet every other year.
Well, Danny, it sounds like Harry's open to considering this regularly.
Well, the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the U.S. Department of Labor does that currently. They say what the inflation rate is, if there is any. It's published yearly, and that would be the agency that would tell you whether or not there was an increase. The problem with the legislature is they don't want to increase the minimum wage because the lobbying efforts of the Chamber of Commerce and those people they come to the legislature and kill that bill. And so that's why I think you see increasingly across the country other states are raising the minimum wage by this method.
There's another important element to this Nevada minimum wage initiative, and that is that employers can opt out of this higher minimum wage if they offer health benefits to their employees. Danny, are there many minimum wage workers getting health benefits?
No, that's something that we don't know, but one of the things we do know is that almost one in four Nevadans don't have health insurance, and what is happening is, you know, if they access the system, one of two things happens. Either they're cared for as an indigent or they tell the provider that they will pay and they are unable to pay. And when that happens, the provider can only raise the cost to those who pay. And so everyone with health insurance have seen those rates rise dramatically. I know of building trades unions in Nevada that pay $7 an hour to maintain their health insurance. And so that was put in there in an effort that if an employer did want to provide health insurance, that they could and not be free of paying the minimum wage. It would be free of paying the dollar. And not, you know, the federal minimum wage is the federal minimum wage. It's the federal law, and you can't supersede it.
Harry, what do businesses make of that?
It probably wouldn't do anything because I think if you look at that percentage of health costs, health care costs to the dollar increase, I don't see you'd have people adding health care costs
because
if they weren't already providing those.
Because are you saying that the cost of adding health care benefits to someone on the minimum wage would be higher than
Correct.
The extra dollar an hour?
Correct.
So, Danny, is this a false option?
I mean, I have an employee here that when we pay, the chamber pays 80% and the employee pays 20%, we had to give her an increase to cover the 20% because it would have actually ended up with her going backwards at the time she got health benefits.
So, Danny, it doesn't sound like much of a choice for employers.
Well, it may not be, and it was just an attempt to offer that. And let me just say, there probably aren't a whole lot of people out there doing that, but if there is someone who's willing to provide that to their people, because there's a lot of people who, for whatever reason, are more interested in the benefits than they are the hourly rate, and there are people out there looking to work for health insurance. And, you know, this problem and the increase in costs are so astronomical that, you know, we're looking at ways to allow small employers to, you know, provide for that health insurance, because oftentimes, like you said, the costs are just prohibitive and they can't. It's not their fault necessarily that they can't provide it because the costs are off the planet. But at the same time, you know, one of the problems is these people accessing the system and then not paying, and the provider has to cover the cost from somewhere, and so they cover it from the people who do have health insurance. So is it going to fix everything? No. Will anybody use it? I don't know, but I think that, you know, that was the attempt, was to try to help an employer who might be interested in it.
Okay. And Danny, and we would love thoughts, to work with you on that. We need to be far more creative in the offerings that we can offer, particularly small employers, to be able to offer some kind of health insurance to their employees. I think when you talk to employers, they would all love to have that opportunity, because it's a good employee retention piece to their overall package.
And we'll have
it's
to,
just
and
so
we'll,
expensive.
And we'll have to end it there. Thank you both very much. Danny Thompson of the Nevada State AFL-CIO and Harry York, CEO of the Reno Sparks Chamber of Commerce. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, what if every Californian who is eligible to vote actually voted? You'll find out when we return.
Should Sacramento build a downtown sports arena? And should voters approve tax dollars to do it? It's a divisive issue with passionate opinions on both sides. We want to hear what you think. Log on to capradio.org and look for the special webpage produced by KXJZ News and Insight, Arena Yes or No. There you can find the latest news, trace the history of the debate, and post your comments. That's at capradio.org.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Millions of Californians are eligible to vote, but don't. You got to wonder what impact all those people would have if they actually showed up on Election Day. A California think tank had decided to investigate. The result was a study called California's Exclusive Electorate. The report's author, Mark Baldessari, research director at the Public Policy Institute of California, says if non-voters participated, there could be some radically different outcomes in local and statewide elections.
Well, it would certainly, the profile of the voters would look very different from the voters we have today. The numbers of voters, of course, would expand dramatically because we have been seeing declining turnouts. And there'd be some surprises at the ballot box because the people who don't vote very often have different views from those who participate in our election process. We know that because we've interviewed about 24,000 Californians over the course of the last year. And we asked them the same questions of those people who vote, don't vote. We're able to track some of their responses. And it's a pretty different electorate. It's a group of people outside of the electorate today whose voices aren't heard, who have some different perspectives.
Could you give us an example of a longstanding policy in California that could be overturned if everyone were to start voting?
Well, let's start with a couple of the limitations on government that have been put into place by voters over the past several decades. One limitation on government is that, of course, very well known as Proposition 13, the property tax limit that was passed by the voters in 1978. When we ask Californians in our surveys whether they think Proposition 13 is a good thing or a bad thing, those people who vote overwhelmingly tell us that property tax limitations through Proposition 13 have been a good thing for California. The important to keep in mind that overwhelmingly most people who vote are homeowners. And for many of those homeowners who've had homes for a long time, having property tax limits is a good thing. If we ask that same question to people who are not voting in elections, a lot of them say that Proposition 13 has been a bad thing for the state. And a lot of those people who don't vote are renters. They're not homeowners. And they have a very different perspective on what it means to limit property taxes and limit the size of government. So if we combine the results for those people who vote and don't vote, all of a sudden what seemed like a very solid majority of people who say that Proposition 13 is a good thing shrinks down to less than 50%.
Goodness.
And that is not something you're going to see in any election anytime soon, because elections are dominated by homeowners. But if you were to actually take a poll of all Californians, you would find that results on Proposition 13 are not really all that strongly supportive of the measure.
What about the two-thirds requirement for passing special local taxes?
Well, that part of Proposition 13 we didn't look at, but we also looked at a different type of government limitation, and that is that's term limits. Legislative term limits, which were also supported by the voters. If we look at how all the voters feel about legislative term limits, we find that they're very supportive of that. But if we look at the overall electorate, they're not really convinced that legislative term limits are the best thing, because many of the people who don't vote don't have as positive opinion about the outcome of a decade and a half of having legislative term limits. The interesting thing about people who don't vote compared to those who do is that they tend to want a larger role for government. They tend to want less restrictions on what government does. And as a result, those people who don't vote could be supportive of, let's say, changing the Proposition 13 term limits or changing the legislative term limits. The important thing to note about people who don't vote, however, is that while they tend to support more government, that can mean things that are, that can mean something that has both liberal and conservative connotations.
How do you mean?
Well, in particular, while the people who don't vote in California say that they lean Democrat more than Republican, they also tell us that they lean more conservative than liberal. And specifically, if we look at social issues like choice on abortion, those people who don't vote tend to be more supportive of the government having a greater role in restricting abortion. So having a greater role for government can mean something very different for people who don't vote than what we're usually accustomed to in California. It can mean that they both want more government spending, and they want more government involvement in personal decisions, abortion.
I'm talking with Mark Baldessari, the research director of the Public Policy Institute of California. We're talking about the report he authored, California's Exclusive Electorate. Is there any way to speculate on how some important issues or races in the November election would be changed if everyone were to vote? For example, how would Governor Schwarzenegger do?
Yeah, so we actually are able to do that because every time we do a survey, We don't just talk to people who are registered to vote or likely to vote, but we talk to all Californians. So in every one of our surveys, we always take a look at what the overall electorate looks like and then compare that to the overall adult population. And let me just give you a couple of examples. The race for governor, which in our most recent survey shows an 18-point lead for Governor Schwarzenegger, over Phil Angelides gets much closer if we take into account everyone. It would be a closer election because, as I mentioned earlier, many of the non-voters in California tend to lean Democratic. If we were to look at the overall adult population, compare that to the people who don't vote, and compare that to the likely voters for approval of Governor Schwarzenegger, the overall adult population gives the governor fairly mixed reviews right now in terms of his approval rating, and likely voters, majority say that they approve of how he's doing in office, and those who don't vote mostly disapprove of how he's doing in office in terms of the performance of his jobs. So views of Governor Schwarzenegger, views of Democratic and Republican candidates are very different. On specific ballot measures, if we look at the five infrastructure bonds, which were placed on the ballot by the governor and four of them by the governor and legislature, one of them by the initiative process, the total $43 billion, likely voters are giving those most of those bonds either a slight majority support, or they're divided in their support for those bond measures for schools, water, transportation, and affordable housing. The people who don't vote overwhelmingly support all of those bond measures, which would dedicate funds to the state's future. If their votes became part of the overall vote in November, those measures would easily pass, each one, whereas today each one of them is in question because there is fairly substantial opposition to each of those bonds, particularly among those likely voters who describe themselves as Republican, conservative, or Schwarzenegger voters.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about who these people are who are not voting and why they don't vote?
We know from our surveys a lot about the profile of the non-voters in California. Many of them are Latino. Many of them are renters. Many of them have not attended college, and many of them are young. Compared to the people who do vote, there's a huge difference in terms of the profile, because those people who routinely vote in our elections are overwhelmingly white, homeowners, majorities are college educated, have incomes of $60,000 or more, most are 45 and older. It is a very starkly different profile of those people who don't vote in California elections. And the numbers are rather dramatic and large in terms of who does and doesn't vote. If we look at, let's say, the most recent election last year, the most recent statewide election, there were about 8 million voters who turned out for the November 2005 election. That is about half of all the registered voters today. There are about 15.7 million registered voters. Altogether, there are about 22.5 million Californians who are registered, who are eligible to register to vote today. So there are about 7 million people who are eligible who aren't registered to vote. There are another 5 million people who aren't currently eligible to vote, largely because of immigration status, who are adults in the population. So there are millions of people in each election whose voices aren't heard, either because they choose not to vote and they're registered voters, or they choose not to register to vote and they're eligible to do so.
Do you know why they choose not to vote?
We asked people in our surveys why they choose not to vote. And we've also explored this for years in the course of our focus groups. Many people say that they're too busy, but many people also say that they feel that their vote doesn't count. And that's always been an interesting issue to probe, what it means when people say that their vote doesn't count. They don't vote because they feel that somebody else is controlling the political system and not them. If they voted, it wouldn't matter because somebody else is manipulating what goes on when political parties make their choices, or when people actually get elected to office and make laws and legislation. So there's a feeling of powerlessness and lack of control of the political process, which causes a lot of people to feel that even if they have the time, it's not worth their time to be part of the political process.
It's a vicious circle, though, isn't it?
It really is, and it's something which, as we watch the current election unfold, and I think we recognize to a certain degree one of the reasons that people don't vote is that the parties and the initiative campaigns don't really talk to people a lot about how important their political participation is. We go through a campaign cycle in which the campaigns tend to zero in on their databases and the people in their databases who they feel are the best most likely to support their candidates and their causes, and they do whatever they can to try to convince other people, to try to create doubts, to try to create confusion, so that the other people won't vote. And if you have two sides of the campaign gearing their messages towards getting out a small electorate that's going to be in favor of their candidate or their cause, you at the end of the day end up with a lot of people who feel like, I'm confused, I'm not sure, and I don't know that I can't really say that it's important for me to be part of this process.
You said earlier that the people who don't vote, that there's a strong economic liberalism and social conservatism, conservatism among those people. Mm-hmm. One could look at that and say that both the Democratic and Republican parties have an interest in not encouraging a big turnout in those people.
Yeah, and I have to say that as our state has gone through tremendous social and economic change in the past couple of decades, that our parties, our political parties, our major political parties, have not really put a lot of effort into expanding the electorate, giving people a reason to belong to a political party, to register to vote and belong to a political party. In the past two decades, since 1990, we have seen virtually no growth in the major political parties. As our state has seen tremendous population growth, we had 12 million Republicans and Democrats in 1990. We have 12 million Republicans and Democrats today. And that's because those people who have taken the trouble to register to vote are largely registering to vote as the client of state outside of the major parties. One might think about what type of political system we might have if both of the major parties made major efforts to get people out to vote. We could probably expect to see very large shares of political participation in the state, but we haven't.
Mark Baldessari, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's Mark Baldessari, Research Director at the Public Policy Institute of California. There's a link to his report, California's Exclusive Electorate, at campradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, we remember the Donner Party. It was 160 years ago this month that these migrants headed for California were stopped in the tracks by a snowstorm at Truckee Lake. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow in Insight, the author of Haunted California tells you about spooky places in the Sacramento Valley. Also, learn how far the bicycle has come. A new exhibit opens soon in Folsom. And later this week, meet author Heather Estay and learn how to throw an election house party. In October 1846, that's 160 years ago this month, a Sierra snowstorm blocked a group of emigrants bound for California. For many of them, Truckee Lake was as far as they would get. The group was known as the Donner Party. As months passed, some members resorted to eating human flesh. The Donner Party has become a shorthand for cannibalism, often the subject of morbid humor. Today, let's look beyond the sensationalism and the cheap jokes with three people who are experts on the Donner Party. We'll start with author Mark McLaughlin. For two decades, he's been studying the weather history of the Sierra Nevada. His new book, The Donner Party, Weathering the Storm, is part of that project. He's in our studio. Mark, welcome back to Insight.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
What kind of storm confronted the Donner Party in late October 1846?
Well, that initial storm was relatively unusual in late October, probably dropped 3, maybe 5 feet of snow total up in the summit area. It's really hard to know the exact numbers. Those actually seem a little high to me. But what happens up there with powerful systems is the wind can tend to drift the snow. And even if it wasn't a natural snowfall, it's what we call wind deposition. And it gained the height of up to chest level, which was plenty enough to stop them from making it over the pass.
And some of them were on foot, I guess, and, you know, with oxen and so on.
Absolutely. I think, believe they made an initial attempt with their wagons, and they were turned back and then made several subsequent attempts. But the other part of that is, even if they, and this is something that I think people misread quite a bit, it's the idea if they made it over the pass, everything would be fine, but you're still up in the high country for many miles, and you would still be dealing with deep snow for quite a long way.
Were winters in the Sierra generally worse than they are today, or better?
You know, it's a good question. I would suggest that temperatures may have been colder, and we did have a lot of big winters. The interesting aspect to this is that the 5 winters previous to the winter of 47 were all relatively mild and what we consider today to be drier than normal.
Also with us on the phone is Frank Mullen, author of the Donner Party Chronicles. He's also a reporter at the Reno Gazette Journal. Frank, thanks for joining us on Insight.
My pleasure, Jeffrey.
Who was the Donner that the Donner Party was named for?
It was named after George Donner, who, with his brother Jacob and their families and the family of James Frazier Reed, left Springfield, Illinois in April of 1846. George Donner was elected captain of the wagon train when the people voted to take the shortcut on the trail.
And why was he elected the captain? Was it his idea to take the shortcut?
No, actually, it seems to be James Frazier Reed's idea. Reed was the more natural leader. He was younger. Donner was in his 60s. Reed was in about 45. But Donner was sort of a patriarchal sort of figure, and Reed was more brash and a man of action kind of thing. And it was said he flaunted his wealth. He had a number of good horses and wagons and trappings and stuff. And so when it came to elect a leader, they elected the patriarchal figure rather than the tough go-getter.
Would they have been better off electing a different captain?
I think if they had Reed with them. Reed was later banished from the train. He had killed a man in basically a road rage altercation in Nevada, probably the first one on record in the state. Had I think Reed stayed with them, I think he might have broken through earlier than some of the party did later on in January. A few of them broke through to tell people at Sutter's Fort they were in trouble. But I think had Reed been with them, they may have gotten over the pass simply because he was more of an action figure kind of guy.
Mm. Also with us on the phone is Gail Green, who's a historian and Donner Memorial State Park interpretist. Gail, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey. I'm glad to be here.
Well, a lot of people left Missouri for California in the spring of 1846 and made it to Sutter's Fort. How did the Donner Party go wrong? Did they make a mistake or were they unlucky?
Well, I think the Donner Party, the part of the problem was that they were always behind the regular wagon trains that were going that year of 1846, and it appealed to them, I believe, just to, if they could take a shortcut, it would help them. And they had read about this shortcut in a Reed and Donner's, I know, in a reading party in Illinois, and he portrayed it to be a shortcut, and that's the women, by the way, just didn't want to do this, but they really didn't have a vote. But I think they were just trying to make up time.
What was the other route? Was it longer?
Yes, it was a little longer. It went up to Fort Hall, and that was blazed by the Stevens, Townsend, Murphy party 2 years before the Donners. And it would go up into Idaho and then back down into Nevada. And actually, after the shortcut, the Donner party could connect to the regular prescribed California Trail.
Mark, tell us what the Donner party would have had on them. What kind of equipment, what kind of animals, what kind of adults did they have when they were just about to get bogged down at Truckee Lake?
Well, the number of total pioneers or immigrants at that point with that, you know, here's one of the things is after they left the what is today Western Nevada, the Truckee Meadows, present-day Reno area, they were pretty much spread out as they were making their way up, and the lead wagons that would have eventually arrived at Truckee Lake around the end of the month, the 30th, the 31st, just about this time period, 160 years ago, they would have had their wagons and livestock, cattle, oxen, dogs, some milk cows, and basically everything that they could have possibly brought with them from their farms back east.
Frank, was that enough to survive a winter?
Well, no, and they had gone through all their dry goods, their flour and any dried meat and things like that they had brought with them, and dried game. And by the time they got up to the lake, they had some provisions that were brought by a man named Stanton with two Miwok Indians from Sutter's Fort to resupply them on mules, but they had very little food. And Patrick Breen, who was entrapped at the lake, began his diary on the 22nd of November, and he said, we have a few cattle left alive and very little food. And then right after that, within a week or so, he talks about boiling hides. When you boil leather, you get glue forming on top, and they would eat the glue to get sustenance.
How long were they stuck there before they made the decision to eat human flesh, or at least some of them did?
That happened towards the end. The Forlorn Hope, well, actually it happened for the first time around Christmas, 1846, and that was in a party called the Forlorn Hope. 15 men and women made a break for it on makeshift snowshoes, and by Christmas Eve they were out of provisions and people were dying, and they made the decision in that group to eat human flesh. The first rescuers who came up to the lake in February, there were only seven men. They couldn't get the all the people out. And then Patrick Breen writes in his diary that the men from California have come and gone. And Mrs. Murphy came to my cabin and says that she will dig up the body of Milt Elliott and commence to eat him. She may have done so ere long or before now. May God save us all. And so it appears that in February, the people at the lake and the Alder Creek camp, which was 6 or 7 miles behind the lake camp, began to eat human flesh of people who had previously died.
Gail, can you tell us what the physical and mental state of the Donner Party was at the time that they resorted to cannibalism? It's hard to imagine.
Well, it's very hard to imagine because we lose people up here in the mountains. We can lose it within days, and they have Gore-Tex. I think they were stretched to the extreme. Here they are emaciated. They take very little rations, 6 days supposedly. They're weak, and they hit a snowstorm that sounds like it was one of the worst ones of that year. And their whole mindset, they had made it through the Wasatch. They had made it through two horrendous deserts, and here they have the Sierras. And I know they thought they're going to make it out of here, and their fortitude was thinking they're going to do it. But I still to this day am just very impressed that any of them made it, because that forlorn hope that Frank was talking about, they took rations for 6 days, and it ended up being around 33 days.
Mark, how did the Donner Party members decide who would be eaten, and was anyone actually killed?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question. The way that historians generally approach it is that there is no direct evidence that at the encampments that anyone was killed for food, for consumption. If it did, when it did happen, it was done with bodies that were outside their cabins. As Frank had mentioned about that forlorn hope, or you could think of it as the snowshoe party, those two Indians, the Miwoks that Sutter had lent to Stanton to bring up to help guide the party in, they were near death, but they were dispatched with gunshots, and they were consumed at the near the end of as the snowshoe party was leaving the snow country.
Frank, did anyone refuse to eat human flesh? And if so, what happened to them?
As far as I know, the only people who refused to eat human flesh were the two Miwok Indians who were eventually killed by William Foster for their flesh. Other families have said, and their descendants have said, for example, the Reeds say they never ate human flesh, and members of the Donner family have said, yeah, other people did, but we didn't, you know, later on. The descendants have taken that position, but it appears as though most of the people who survived were in that position and did so, and that there's a lot of denial that's gone on since then.
Gail, the Donner Party members who survived and made it down to Sutter's Fort, how did they do that? Did they wait out the winter, or did people rescue them?
No, they were rescued. There were three legitimate rescue parties that came up here, and those that made it from the rescue parties, and they all didn't make it on those three rescue attempts. They made it through, like, in springtime, and I think the last rescue individual that left here at Donner was good old Louis Kiesberg, who it was actually a salvage party that came up here because they didn't think very many people were alive at that point. And he left around August 21st, 22nd.
Or April.
And when did the final surviving member arrive at Sutter's Fort? Frank, do you know that?
It was April 25th, 1847, that Louis Kiesberg arrived at Johnson's Ranch, which was the first settlement when you came down the Sierra on your way to Sutter's Fort. So the entrapment lasted from October 31st, for Kiesberg anyway, October 31st to April 25th, 1847.
Goodness. Mark, how did the survivors do once they had physically recovered? Once they get to Sutter's Fort, they physically recovered. Do we know how they fared emotionally and psychologically?
Well, the postscript is rather optimistic in a sense for many of the survivors. Of course, they were here before the gold rush. If you think about this, the timing of it all, they were here. It was just the very next year in January of 48 that gold is discovered at Marshall's. And of course, the gold rush kicks in earnest in 1849. And they would be in a position to be in what, of course, at that time was, a kind of a military protectorate or a territory for the United States. Because one of the sidebars to this story is that as the Donner families were making their way and the people that were with them were making their way out, the Mexican-American War had broken out in California. And that was another distraction for them in the mountains. They're in the mountains, but the people in California, a lot of the men, the available manpower that it would take to go up and rescue them, were caught up in the war and the fighting with the resources and everything else. But as it turned out, that many of the families did okay and went on and lived what you would consider to be fairly normal lives.
Frank, how did Californians and Americans in general react to the story of the Donner Party and what had happened?
Generally, it was a horrific story that was even then exaggerated by the California Star newspaper as being even more horrible than it was, that people were intentionally eating flesh and were preferring flesh to other foods and so forth, and killing their own family members, and all kinds of horrible myths arose almost immediately. And there was a great deal of horror throughout the country, and some of the families changed their names. There was a stigma attached to it. The Donner children would go to school in California, and people would say, oh, don't sit next to Eliza. She eats people.
Oh, goodness.
And there'd be a stigma attached to it, but it did affect the immigration, I believe, the following year. But after the discovery of gold, nothing mattered, and people came every which way to California, including the very bad shortcut that the Donners had helped pioneer.
And finally and quickly, Gail, at Donner Memorial State Park, can we see where they camped?
Yes, you can see the sites here at our park. We have two of them. We actually call it the Lake Camps, and that is the monument where sits up on top of the Breen Cabin, and then the Murphy Eddy Cabin that's a big boulder behind us with a plaque on it. There's one just about another double cabin that's about 3/4 of a mile away, and then the Donner Brothers were about 6-7 miles away because when it started snowing that November 3rd, they got stuck out at what we call Alder Creek Camp.
Okay, and we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to all my guests in the studio. Mark McLaughlin, weather historian. His book is The Donner Party, Weathering the Storm. Also on the phone, Frank Mullen, author of The Donner Party Chronicles, and Gail Green of Donner Memorial State Park. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Bye.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and today's associate producer was Rob Whitlock. Insight staff includes technical director Mark Jones, assistant producer Jen Picard, and senior producer Benjamin Jonas Keeling. And thank you for joining us.